which at least helped my parents out financially. I was so mad when she got busted and dropped from that show. She shook her head. I'm all about taking one for the team, but her being so stupid, it stung. Like all those years, all that money was for nothing. As she said this, another girl skated onto the ice. It took me a minute to realize it was Rosie. Maybe it was the distance, or that she'd changed into skating gear, but she looked different. She began circling the outer edge of the ice, slowly picking up speed. And even with this most basic of moves, it was clear she was better than the girl we'd been watching. There was a simple, undiluted grace to her movements, something holy in contrast to her normal, nose-wrinkled, complaining self. As if, instead of shriveling in the cold like most people, she bloomed. Layla was also watching as she passed by once, then twice. The third time she turned, lifting her chin to acknowledge us, and Layla nodded back, giving her a smile. This surprised me after all we'd been talking about. But then, a lot about Layla was a mystery. "She's really nervous," she explained to me, as if sensing this. "She's been working out alone, but this is the first time he's agreed to see her since all this happened. That's why she was being such a bitch, or one reason anyway." After a few words with Arthur, the younger girl left the ice and he waved Rosie over. They talked for a moment, and then he gestured for her to take another lap, turning to watch her as she began. "Oh God, I can't watch. Even at practice, I get crazy nervous for her. I used to be such a mess during competitions. My mom would beg me to go get fries." She pulled out her phone, typing in her passcode, then opened her pictures. "When I did stay, though, I was always glad. Look at this." She handed me the phone where a video was now playing on the screen. It was of another rink, a fancier one, with Rosie twirling in its center. She started slowly, her arms spread wide, then began to speed up, pulling them in against her until she was almost a blur. Then, as the tinny, distant music came to a sudden stop, she did as well, striking a pose with her head thrown back. As the crowd applauded and cheered, the sound a thunderous roar, she smiled. "That was the last year she competed," Layla said. She flipped to the next shot, which showed Mrs. Chatham, clearly in better health, posing with Layla, Rosie, who held a bouquet of roses, and a huge trophy. Off to the side was a heavyset guy in a shapeless sweatshirt and jeans, half cut off by the camera. At first I assumed he just stumbled into the picture accidentally. Then I realized. "Is that?" I stopped, then picked up the phone, narrowing my eyes at it. "Mac," she finished for me. "Yeah, it is." I reached down, using my thumb and forefinger to enlarge that part of the photo until his face filled the screen. With a much heftier frame and a bad case of acne, he looked so different. I couldn't quite believe it was the same person, but the eyes were identical, the hair with the lock tumbling over his forehead. "Wow, what did he..." "Lost 30 pounds for starters, and when he started eating better, his skin cleared up." She picked up another fry. "Crazy, right? Sometimes I still see him in the hallway at home and wonder who he is."
"I can't believe he looked like that."
"You would if you saw how he used to eat. The boy could consume. He was like Irv, but without the height, muscle, and football. And it was all junk."
"I can't even imagine that."
I was still staring at his face, wider, pockmarked. "What made him want to change?" "Wouldn't you?" she asked, nodding at the picture. She ate the fry. "Really, though, I think he finally just got sick of being the fat kid. It was what he'd been for as long as I could remember. Rosie was talented, I was cute, he was fat." This wasn't news to me, How your entire life could come down to one word, and not of your choosing. I knew it better than anyone. Each time I was reminded, though, I wished that much harder it wasn't the case. I said, "So, how did he lose the weight?"
"He started by hiking in the woods. Then he moved up to jogging, and finally outright running. He'd get up before school and just disappear back there for hours. Still does, every single morning."
"Really?"
"Just hearing him leave at 5:30 a.m. makes me tired," she said. "Plus, he never eats, like, anything fun anymore. Just protein, veggies, and fruit. I wouldn't last a day, or even an hour."
There was a shout from the ice, and we both looked back at Rosie, who had just landed a jump, apparently rather sloppily. Arthur shook his head, then barked something else, and she circled around, nodding, her hands on her hips.
"Ugh," Layla said, wiping her fingers with a napkin. "I can't take this. It's too stressful. Before I know it, I'll be buying more of these awful fries just to cope."
I smiled, then looked at my watch. It was 5:45. I had to be home in 15 minutes, which meant even if I left right that second, I'd be pushing it. I was not looking forward to dinner and more discussion of Lincoln's family day, however, so I stayed put long enough to see Rosie do a few spins, stumble once, and finally earn the slightest of approving smiles from Arthur, the sight of which caused Layla to audibly exhale.
"I'll see you tomorrow," I told her, gathering up my stuff. "Sorry I can't take you guys home."
"It's fine. Mac's always somewhere nearby, and you've done more than enough." I smiled, then waved as I started down the steps to the exit. Before I pushed open the door to the lobby, I looked back just in time to catch Rosie doing her best jump yet, then sticking the landing and gliding on. It seemed like just the right note to depart upon. With everything perfect, at least for a second. I left before I could see anything else.
Chapter 9.
"You're here!"
Jen reached forward, grabbing my wrist and pulling me through the door with one big yank.
"I am so, so happy to see you. It's been ages!"
When she gave me a sloppy kiss on the cheek, though, I knew something was up. Jen was a lot of things, but effusive wasn't one of them.
"Hey," I said as she began pulling me down the hallway. "What's going on?"
"We are having so much fun," she said.
"Come on, you have to meet Margaret."
Judging by the dragging, it was clear I didn't have a choice in the matter, so I let her take me into the kitchen. There I saw Meredith at the island, looking uneasy, while a dark-haired girl with her back to me dumped some ice in the blender.
"Sydney's here!"
Jen, who also was not loud, ever, shouted.
"And she needs a drink."
"Of course she does," Margaret said, turning around. She had long black hair tumbling over her shoulders, bright blue eyes, and a sprinkling of freckles. A pretty girl with a kind of spark to her you saw right away. "And it's a fresh batch to boot. Let me get you a glass." It was when she moved aside, reaching up into the cabinet, that I saw the rum bottle. I looked back at Meredith, who had her own glass, which looked untouched. Two others on the island held only slushy dregs.
"What are we drinking?"
"Piña coladas," Jen announced.
"Margaret's special recipe, and they are delicious."
"The ice is key," Margaret explained, pouring a glass, then topping off the two empty ones. "Most people don't realize that." When she handed me my glass, I took it, but didn't drink.
"So your parents aren't here?"
"No, they're in the living room," Jen replied.
I just looked at her.
"I'm joking! Of course not. They're out for the night. I told them we were going to Antonella's for pizza and then watching movies."
"And we're not?"
I asked.
Is that what you want to do? Margaret asked me.
No, I said. There was something about her tone, the way she raised an eyebrow, that made me say this automatically. I just didn't realize.
Since when do you drink, Jen?
She put down her glass, then wiped a hand over her lips.
What do you mean? I've drank before.
When?
All the time. You know that, Sydney.
Margaret was watching this exchange, an expression of mild amusement on her face. Over at the island, Meredith picked up her glass and took a sip.
Okay, I said, not wanting to point out that I'd known Jen since preschool and never seen her do anything more than take a parent-approved sip of wine at Christmas dinner. I sniffed my drink.
What's in this?
Oh, just drink it, Margaret said, flipping her hand at me. It'll help you relax.
I looked at her.
I don't need to relax.
She took a big gulp of her own drink.
All I'm saying is that this is a birthday celebration, so let's have fun, okay?
Seconded, Jen said, holding out her glass. Margaret did the same before nodding at Meredith, who raised hers as well. Then they all looked at me. I picked up my glass. To Jen, happy birthday.
Happy birthday,
everyone repeated. Clink. Jen immediately took a big gulp, but Margaret kept her eyes on me, not drinking, as I raised my glass to my mouth, taking a sip. Then she did the same, still watching me.
Okay, she said, and smiled. Now it's a party.
Just text him. Don't think about it. Just do it.
Jen shook her head, blushing.
I can't. It's too weird.
Oh, please. Margaret reached across the couch, grabbing the phone.
I'll do it then.
Don't!
Jen shrieked, lunging at her to get it back.
Oh my God, Margaret, if you do that, I swear I'll...
Thank me forever for hooking you up with the guy you're crazy about?
You're welcome. She started typing on the phone with one hand while batting Jen away with the other.
There, it's done. Now we wait.
I hate you,
Jen said, but she was grinning, her face flushed. She'd had two drinks by my count since I'd arrived.
Maybe, Margaret told her, but when he shows up, you'll love me.
The he in question was Chris McMichaels, who apparently my best friend had been madly in love with for ages, although she'd never mentioned it to me. Margaret, however, knew that he sat behind Jen in world history, often asked her if she could spare paper or a pen, and had recently broken up with his longtime girlfriend, Hannah Rigsby, leaving him, in Margaret's words, ripe for the picking.
He probably thinks I'm crazy,
Jen moaned, putting her head in her hands.
Texting him on a Friday night?
If he didn't want to hear from you, he wouldn't have given you his number, Margaret said, topping off each of their glasses.
That was for a group project.
Margaret waved her hand.
Details.
Just then the phone buzzed. Jen went for it, but Margaret got there first, scanning the screen.
Well, look at this. He's around and says he'll stop by with some friends.
What?
Jen shrieked. The sound was shrill, grating, grabbing the phone. She read the text, then looked up, eyes wide.
You told him we were drinking?
You did, Margaret said. It's a party, right?
Oh my God.
Jen grabbed my arm.
Chris McMichaels may be coming over here? To my house? I don't know if I can handle this.
Of course you can. I'll make another round.
With that, Margaret picked up the empty pitcher and turned on her heel, going back into the kitchen. Finally, it was just the three of us.
Jen, I said as she took another sip, are you sure about this?
About what?
I glanced at Meredith, who looked as hesitant as I felt.
I mean, come on. You don't drink. And now you have guys coming over?
She turned to look at me, annoyed.
What is wrong with you tonight?
Me? I said.
You're the one acting weird.
I'm having fun, Sydney. It's my birthday.
I know, I said. I'm your best friend, remember?
Then why are you being such a buzzkill?
She shook her head, sighing.
Honestly, I'm shocked. With your history, I figured you'd be the last person to be so judgy.
Across the couch, Meredith's eyes widened. I forced myself to take a breath before I said,
"My history?"
"Your brother," she said, her voice flat. From the kitchen, the blender began whirring.
"I mean, I get it. Maybe you think that if I drink, I'll end up in jail too? But I won't. So just calm down, okay? Have your drink. Relax."
I didn't even know what to say to this. She was like a stranger, but with the familiar features and mannerisms I knew as well as my own. I lowered my voice, then said, "I can't believe you just brought Peyton into this." She rolled her eyes.
"Oh, calm down. It's not like it's some big secret. Margaret already knows."
Margaret walked into the room, the blender pitcher in her hand.
"Margaret knows what?"
"Nothing," I said, giving Jen a hard look. "Never mind." The next half hour was consumed by Margaret giving Jen what she called the express makeover, which consisted of putting on a more low-cut shirt, adding some jewelry, and layering on several coats of mascara. Margaret changed as well, into a dress she'd packed in her overnight bag. Clearly she'd been anticipating a wardrobe transition, unlike the rest of us. Meanwhile, they both continued downing drinks, getting more and more sloppy. On the upside, neither noticed that Meredith and I had switched to water. At 9:30, about when the guys were expected, Meredith bailed.
"Party pooper!"
Margaret called out from the kitchen, where she was giving needed volume to Jen's hair, a practice that apparently required clouds of hairspray.
"Buzzkill!"
Jen chimed in. "I have a meet tomorrow afternoon," Meredith said quietly to me, like I was the one who needed a reason. "And this is weird." "Seconded," I said, holding up my water. She held hers against it, then smiled. "Are you staying the night? I don't really want to leave her here like this." Meredith glanced back at the kitchen, where Jen, I noticed, was suddenly looking a little queasy. "Uh-oh."
"You're a good friend, Sydney."
"So are you." I reached forward, giving her a hug. "Good luck tomorrow."
"Thanks."
She waved toward the kitchen, but only Margaret waved back. Once the door was shut behind her, I went to check on Jen.
"You okay?" I asked her.
"You don't look so good."
"She's fine. She just needs to eat something," Margaret said, although I saw Jen wince hearing this.
"Let's order pizza. What's the number for that place you like, Jen?"
"They don't deliver,"
Jen mumbled, then got up off the bar stool, putting out a hand to steady herself.
I'm going to go to the bathroom."
She made her way across the room, using the wall for support. Margaret watched her go, then took a sip of her drink.
"She'll be fine," she told me. "A quick puke is like hitting the reset button."
I watched as she picked up a compact, looking at her own face. Then I said, "She doesn't drink, just so you know."
"Her empty glass says otherwise," she replied, scooping out a bit of gloss on her fingertip.
She ran it across her lips, then looked at me.
"Look, when I showed up with the rum, she wasn't exactly protesting.
She probably just wanted to impress you."
"You can read her mind now?"
I'm her best friend. I've known her since we were in preschool.
Well, then you're aware that she's a girl who can make her own choices, she said, shutting the compact with a click.
Go check on her, will you? I'm going to order some food so we have something here for the guys when they come.
She then picked up her phone, indicating the conversation was over. I could feel my temper rising as I walked down the hallway to the powder room, inside which I could hear Jen retching. I knocked lightly on the door, then pushed it open. Hey, it's me. Jen was huddled over the toilet, resting her head on one arm. She looked awfully pale, and the room smelled strongly of coconut.
Ugh. I'm dying, she moaned. I'm going to die on my birthday, which is really symmetrical, but unfortunate.
I smiled. This was my Jen.
You're not dying. You're just drunk. I feel awful.
She turned to look at me. Damp strands of hair stuck to her forehead. So much for the added volume.
Do you hate me?
Of course not. I picked up the hand towel from next to the sink, then soaked it in cold water. Why would I?
Because I brought up Peyton and made you drink.
You didn't make me do anything. I handed her the towel. Put this on your face. It'll help. She did, and I slid down to sit against the door, my knees to my chest.
You don't like Margaret, she said finally.
It wasn't a question. I don't know her, I replied, sidestepping it anyway.
She's really nice, Sid, I swear, and so funny. And you know, not from here. She doesn't see me the way everyone else does. She thinks I could date Chris McMichaels and drink piña coladas and be different, you know?
I nodded. I did understand in my own way. Not the boy or drinking part, but the clean slate that came with a new friend. I miss you, I said, feeling bad about even thinking this while I was with her.
I miss you, too.
She looked at me again.
Will you stay tonight? I know you weren't planning to.
Sure, I said. Let me just make sure it's okay. My mom answered on the second ring, and she sounded upset. At first, I thought this might be because I was calling so close to curfew, and she assumed I was angling for an extension. But I found out soon enough that, once again, it had nothing to do with me.
You may as well, she said, once I asked if I could stay, since we're not going to Lincoln tomorrow.
I blinked, surprised.
We're not?
Silence. Then,
your brother apparently has had his visiting privileges rescinded. Of course, I can't find out why, despite multiple efforts to contact the director of the prison.
She said this like prison was high school, and contacting the office could fix anything. Not for the first time, I wondered if my mother really understood where Peyton was.
I'm sorry, Mom, I said. I know you were looking forward to that.
I was.
She sounded so defeated. I hadn't thought anything could be worse than her being sad. This whole experience, it just kept teaching. After a moment, she rallied, saying,
Tell Jen happy birthday and I'll see you in the morning. Love you.
Love you too.
Back in the bathroom, Jen was looking slightly better, with a little color creeping into her cheeks. She still wasn't ready to be too far from the toilet, however, so I went to fill Margaret in on what was going on. I was almost to the kitchen when I heard voices and realized the guys had arrived. They were gathered around the island, and Margaret, as she poured them drinks. She'd taken off her shoes and added bright red lipstick since I'd seen her last. When she saw me, she smiled like we were best friends.
Sydney,
she called out, and the guys all looked at me. I knew them, of course, as we'd all been in school together since kindergarten. Besides Chris McMichaels, who had a sister in Peyton's grade, there was Charlie Jernigan, who also lived in the Arbors, and Huck Webster, captain of the Perkins Day soccer team.
"How's the birthday girl?"
"Fine," I answered, walking up to them. Chris was already drinking from his glass, while Charlie and Huck were still sniffing theirs. "She'll be out in a sec." "I poured you a fresh one." Margaret held out a glass to me. "You've got some catching up to do." I took the drink without comment, then had a sip. In truth, it smelled too much like the bathroom I'd just left, but I wasn't going to give her anything to comment on. "Thanks."
"How's the new school, Sydney?"
Charlie asked me.
"You liking it?"
I nodded. "It's good. Different." "I hear you switched to Jackson High," Margaret said.
"Why?"
"I was ready for a change," I replied.
"That's more a revolution than a change."
She adjusted her dress. "I hear there are fights there every day, and that's with the girls. My friend who used to go there, she wouldn't even go in the bathroom."
"Not true," I told her. "Anyway, Sydney's tough," Chris said, smiling at me. "No one's gonna mess with her."
"Exactly," I said. "They're all scared of me already." The guys laughed. Margaret twisted a ring around her finger, then sighed.
"I'm bored," she said. "Let's play a drinking game. Who's got a quarter?"
With this, she led them over to the kitchen table, bringing the pitcher with her. I went back to check on Jen, only to find her asleep on the bathroom floor. So much for the birthday girl.
"Hey," I said, kneeling down beside her and shaking her arm.
"Jen, wake up."
"It's not time to get up yet," she mumbled, rolling over and pressing her cheek into the tiles.
There was a sharp knock at the door. Instinctively, I knew it was one of the boys. They even announced themselves differently.
"Just a minute," I called out.
Okay.
Then footsteps retreating. From the kitchen, I could hear Margaret laughing.
"Jen,"
I said, shaking her shoulder again. She squeezed her eyes shut tightly into slits, as if this might actually make me go away.
"You have to get up. You don't want Chris to see you like this, right?"
She groaned, clearly annoyed, but allowed me to get her into a seated position. Then her eyes flew open.
"Chris is here? Are you serious?"
"He's in the kitchen, with Margaret." Her head fell forward, hitting her chest.
"Oh, God, this is awful. It's not like I had a chance, but if he sees me all pukey like this..."
"He won't," I told her. "Just focus on standing up. I'll get you out of here." She moaned again, but leaned back onto her hands, pushing herself to her feet while I eased the door open and peered down the hallway. The quarters game was still going on in the kitchen, with Margaret at the head of the table, Chris opposite her, and Charlie and Huck on either side. As I watched, Chris bounced a coin into a cup, then pointed at Margaret. She grinned, picking up her glass. I looked back at Jen, who was holding onto the sink for support.
"Come on, it's now or never."
She stepped forward, and I slid my arm over her shoulder, then flipped off the bathroom light before stepping into the dark hallway. It was only about 4 feet to the living room, through which I planned to access the stairs to get her to her bedroom. After a few steps, though, there was a sharp, desperate squeeze of my hand. I stopped walking.
"Might puke," she whispered.
I waited, holding my own breath. Then she exhaled.
"Okay, let's keep going."
We continued like this, past the sofa and coffee table, then the piano, stopping twice more. Just as we passed the front door, the bell sounded.
"Oh, God,"
Jen moaned, squeezing my hand again.
I might...
This time, I had a feeling she meant it. Without thinking, totally desperate, I threw the door open and pushed her out onto the front steps, where she grabbed the wrought iron railing, leaned over it, and heaved into the bushes. On the steps beside her, holding a pizza box and wearing a Seaside Pizza t-shirt, was Mac Chatham. At first, this fact just did not compute. It was like I dreamed or conjured him, except for the throwing up part. Gingerly, he stepped aside as Jen puked again, then looked at me, raising his eyebrows. "Hi," I managed to say over Jen's retching. "What's up?" He gave me a flat look.
"You ordered pizza?"
"I didn't," I said. Now he looked confused. "I mean, they did, or this girl here did. I didn't realize..."
"Sydney,"
Jen moaned, then slid down into a heap on the steps by his feet.
"Help."
"Excuse me," I said to Mac, shooting him an apologetic look as I shut the door behind me. Then came out and crouched down next to Jen. I ran a hand over her matted hair, then explained, "It's her birthday."
"Oh," he cleared his throat. "Happy birthday."
At this, she slumped into me. Before I knew what was happening, her head was in my lap, legs curled up against the railing. I just sat there, not sure what to do. A moment later, she was snoring. I looked up at Mac. I've got money in my pocket. What do I owe you for the pizza?" I figured he'd be more than relieved to tell me, get paid and be on his way, as I could not imagine a more unpleasant scenario to stumble into. Instead, setting what I did not yet realize would be a precedent, Mac surprised me.
"Let's get her inside first," he said. "The last thing you want is neighbors seeing this."
He had a point. The houses on Jen's street were close together, and all the ones across the way still had lights on.
"You don't have to help me," I told him. "Really."
To this, he said nothing. Instead, just holding out the pizza warmer to me. I took it, not sure what was happening, until he bent down, scooping Jen up in his arms. Her head flopped against his shoulder, and she stirred slightly, but then she was out again.
"Lead the way," he said.
I did. Through the front door, where I put down the warmer on a side table, and then up the stairs and down the hall to Jen's dark room. As I flicked on the light, stepping inside, it occurred to me that of all the ways I'd thought this night might end, me in a bedroom with Mac Chatham was the very last one of them. He, however, seemed pretty much at ease, as if he dumped unconscious strange girls into their beds on a regular basis, which I could only hope he did not. Once Jen hit the mattress, she groaned and curled into a ball, pressing her face into her pillow. I went over and took off her shoes.
"You'll probably want to get her a glass of water," he told me. "And a trash can, if there's one around."
There was, and I got it, along with the water and a damp towel, which I put on her forehead. When all this was done, I stepped back beside Mac, who was just inside the doorway. "She never drinks," I told him. I don't know what she was thinking.
"She probably wasn't," he replied. "It happens, especially on birthdays."
"She'll be okay, right?"
"Just needs to sleep it off."
I bit my lip, still worried.
"Sydney, she's fine."
There was something in the way he said this. My name so familiar. The sentiment so confident and reassuring. That was more touching, actually, than anything else he'd done so far. "Thank you," I said to him. "Seriously. I don't know what I would have done if you hadn't shown up."
"All pizza guys have this kind of training. It's required."
I felt myself smile right at him before realizing this was the first time I'd talked to him alone
since the day we'd first met.
And I was talking to him, not blushing or stammering, at least so far.
Who knew a night could end so far from where it started, even when you stayed in?
I should let you go, I said. I'm sure they need you back for more deliveries, right?
This is the last one of the night, actually.
He reached up, scratching his temple. But I do need to get home. I'm supposed to bring burgers and fries from Webster's to Layla and my mom. And they're serious when it comes to their food.
So I'm learning, I said. We stepped out into the hallway, and I turned off Jen's light, easing the door shut behind us. Halfway down the stairs, we bumped into Margaret and Chris.
Sydney? She said, her eyes widening as she glimpsed Mac behind me.
What are you doing?
Considering she was alone with the guy Jen had clearly stated she was crushing on, in Jen's house, on her way to where there were only bedrooms, I wanted to ask her the same thing. Instead, I said, "This is Mac. He's a friend of mine from school."
"A friend," she repeated, drawing the word out.
She looked at Chris.
"And what were you two doing upstairs?"
"Checking on Jen," I told her, narrowing my eyes at her. "Just like you are, right?"
"Right,"
she said, not missing a beat. "Of course." I stepped around her, brushing past as I went down the stairs with Mac behind me. As he passed her, she noticed his t-shirt.
"Wait,"
she said, turning around to look down at us.
"Is this... are you the pizza guy?"
She said this with a half laugh, her voice rising at the end. I'd already decided I disliked her, but it was only then that I felt a full-on bolt of rage. I was about to tell her where she could stick her pizza in detail, but then Max spoke first.
1742 is your total, he told her. Small bills appreciated.
Margaret just looked at him, her expression icy. He stared back, clearly unfazed. Finally, she turned to me.
Money's on the counter in an envelope. Don't overtip.
With this, she turned and began to climb the stairs again. Chris stayed where he was, his expression hesitant.
"Hey," he said to me, his voice low.
"I..."
"Come on," Margaret barked from the landing. There was a beat, and then he, too, turned and disappeared upstairs. My face was hot as I walked down the hallway to the kitchen, embarrassed and pissed off all at once.
"She's nice," Max said. "Friend of yours?"
"No," I said flatly. In the kitchen, we found Huck and Charlie still at the table, now taking plain shots and throwing cocktail peanuts into each other's mouths. They were drunk enough to not really notice us, but I saw Mac take them in as I found the envelope Jen's mom had left, the words, "For your birthday dinner," in a flowery script on the front. If only she knew. I took out 25, sliding it over to him. He handed the 5 back.
"Take it," I said, pushing it at him.
He moved it back toward me.
"Sydney, come on."
My move.
"Mac, it's the least I can do."
His.
"I'm not taking your charity."
Me.
"It's not my money."
Him.
"I don't care."
I reached to push the bill again, and he did too, our hands meeting right over Abe Lincoln's face. Neither of us moved. I could feel the warmth of his fingertips, barely tangible, against mine. We stayed there for 1 second, 2. Then, from somewhere, a buzzing sound. Matt kept his hand on the 5, reaching into a back pocket. He pulled out his phone and glanced at the screen, then showed it to me. "Layla," said the caller ID at the top. The message read only,
"Where are my fries?"
I smiled.
"That's a lot of question marks."
"I told you,
she's serious."
He lifted his fingers away from mine, barely, and pushed the bill one last time in my direction.
Then he glanced at Huck and Charlie, who were giggling like girls over something at the table.
You gonna be okay here?
Yeah, I said. I've known them forever. They're fine. He nodded, then put his phone back in his pocket and started for the door. I followed him, pulling it open as he took out the pizzas from the warmer and handed them to me. As he went outside, I said, "Thanks again. For everything."
"No problem. Like I told you, it's part of the job."
"Sure it is." I stood there holding the boxes as he walked down the steps into the truck, pulling open the driver's side door. Upstairs, Margaret was doing God knew what with Chris McMichaels, and I had two more drunk people to deal with once I returned to the kitchen. But Jen was safe. So was I, and at least there was pizza. I waved at Mac as he backed down the driveway, and he blinked his brights at me before he drove away. Back in the kitchen, the guys jumped on the pies, diving right in, but I went over to the counter. That five was still sitting there. Unlike some people, I wasn't one to take things that weren't mine, so I found one in my wallet and put it in the envelope before claiming the original bill as my own. As I folded it carefully, I walked back to the front door, peering out at the empty street. Max always somewhere nearby, Layla had told me, but I hadn't realized how true it really was. That night, curled up on the other side of Jen's bed, her soft breathing filling the room, I slept with one hand in my pocket, the bill between my fingers. Each time I woke up, I made sure it was still there. Chapter 10. Local teen faces tragedy, rises above, the headline read. Just below it, there was a picture of David Ibarra in his wheelchair. He was smiling. Suddenly, it made sense. Why, when I'd come into the kitchen moments earlier, I'd found my dad standing over the newspaper, which was open on the table. His back was to me, but I could see he had one hand to his mouth. His shoulders were shaking. "Dad?" He put his other hand down on the table, sucking in a breath before turning around.
"Hey," he said. "Ready for breakfast?"
I nodded as he shut the paper, then walked over to the stove, where a pan of scrambled eggs sat on the burner. My dad was a breakfast person. He started every day with a minimum of eggs, bacon or sausage, and toast. He was also an early riser, often gone by the time I came down for school, leaving just leftovers and the smell of pork products behind. Finding him still in the kitchen at 7 a.m. was odd enough. Discovering him crying bordered on terrifying. I'd eyed the paper as he prepared a huge plate for me, wondering what he'd been looking at. It wasn't until his phone rang that I got a chance to find out. "David Ibarra is having a good day. He is not in pain. He just hit a high score on his favorite video game, and he's about to dig into a deluxe pizza. For some, these things might be no big deal, but for David, who was hit by a drunk driver 7 months ago and paralyzed, every day is a gift." I felt my stomach twist. I could hear my dad talking out in the hallway. Quickly, I kept reading. It was February 15th, and David was once again playing War World. Competitive doesn't do justice to how he and his cousin Ricardo were when it came to the popular video game. They could play for hours and often did, staying up late. "That night," David says, "was especially epic, even for us. We played for so long I could barely keep my eyes open. Eventually I did fall asleep. I woke up with the controller on my chest." He knew he was already in trouble, but figured by waking up in his own bed he could maybe do some damage control. After all, his house was only 2 blocks away. It was about 2 a.m. when he climbed onto his bike and started the short trip through the dark streets.
He was almost there when he saw the headlights.
It was crazy, he remembers. Like there were no cars nowhere. And then all of a sudden, one was right in front of me, and they weren't stopping. He has no recollection of the accident itself, something his mother considers a blessing. His first memory is coming to on the curb and realizing his legs were twisted up behind him. Then, the pain. I could hear his footsteps. My dad was coming back. Quickly, I shut the paper, pushing it away from me just before he rounded the corner into sight.
"How's breakfast?" he asked.
I picked up my fork, forcing down a bite of eggs.
"Good.
Thanks. Where's Mom?"
"She's not feeling well," he said,
refilling his mug from the coffee maker.
"Went back to bed."
My mom got up even earlier than my dad. She always brought the paper in and read it front to back. I could just see her, her own coffee at her elbow, like always, turning the page to see that headline and picture. All over town, people were doing the same thing. On my way to school, I was suddenly keenly aware of all the newspapers I saw in driveways and for sale by convenience stores and gas stations. Walking into school, I felt like everyone was staring at me, even though I had no idea if anyone at Jackson knew Peyton was my brother. During homeroom, while everyone chattered and laughed around me, ignoring the morning announcements, I pulled up the article on my phone. "Two lives converge," the header for the next section read. As far as anyone knew, Peyton Stanford was getting his life together, after a string of arrests for breaking and entering and drug possession, among other things, he'd completed a stay in rehab and had been sober for over a year. But on that February night, after an evening spent drinking and getting high, he climbed behind the wheel of his BMW sports car. Like David Ibarra, he was heading home. The bell rang loud as always, and I closed my eyes, suddenly feeling sick. All around me, people were gathering up their stuff and pushing toward the door, but I just sat there, the words blurring before me. It wasn't until my teacher, Mrs. Satcher, said my name that I realized I was the only one left in the room.
"Sydney?"
I looked up at her. She taught English and was young and nice, with a kind face and a tendency to belly laugh.
"You okay?"
"Yeah," I said, putting my phone in my backpack. "Sorry." For the rest of the morning, whenever I had a chance, I made myself read more of the article. During the few free minutes between the end of history and the bell, at my locker when I had a short way to go from English to calculus. By the time I got to lunch, I had only one paragraph to go. There are times David is angry about what happened to him, when he can't help but think how things could have been different. If he'd just stayed at his cousin's house, if he'd left 10 minutes earlier. It's hard not to follow this line of thinking and all the dark places it can lead him. But right now he's not doing that. Today is a good day.
"Here you go,"
the guy behind the counter at the Great Griller's food truck said. I looked up to see him holding the bag with the sandwich I'd ordered.
"Need anything else?"
I shook my head, suddenly sure that if I spoke, I might burst into tears. So instead, I just took some deep breaths and walked over to where Layla and everyone else was sitting. The topic of conversation was band names, one that came up regularly during these discussions. "Hey Dude's" new concept, Eric maintained, warranted a new moniker. But of course, it had to be perfect.
"What about the Logan Oxford experience?"
Irv asked.
"Like Hendrix, but not."
Eric just looked at him.
"That is so far away from what I'm talking about. I can't even justify it with a response."
Irv shrugged, hardly bothered. Layla said,
"It should have something to do with boy bands, though.
but with a twist.
No, no, Eric sighed, as if our collective ignorance literally pained him. What I need is a name that works with a wider concept, not a gimmick, able to really explain the meaning, the irony, because people are clearly not getting it. I can't have people thinking we're just a retro cover band.
Then maybe you shouldn't be playing covers of old songs, Layla pointed out.
It's not about covers, he told her. It's about the universal experience of mass consumption of music, how a song can remind you of something specific in your own life, like it belongs to you. But how personal can it really be if a million other people feel the same way about it? It's like a fake meaning on top of a manufactured meaning divided by a true meaning.
Silence. Then Irv said,
Dude, did you take your Ritalin today?
Over on his own bench where he was cramming for a math test, Max snorted and opened a stick of string cheese. Since the night he'd shown up at Jen's a week earlier, I'd had trouble forgetting that moment we'd stood with both our hands on that $5 bill. It, however, was a memory I liked to relive. Unlike the one currently in my head, which was canceling out more than my appetite.
You okay?
Layla asked me. She nodded at my lunch, still in the bag.
You're not eating.
Not hungry, I told her.
What's that like?
Irv asked, and everyone laughed. Layla, however, kept her eyes on me long enough that I picked up the bag and took out my sandwich. The fries that came with it I handed over to her without comment.
Great grillers?
She asked. I nodded, and she wrinkled her nose.
They're too skinny for my taste, usually. I don't like a spindly fry, but since you're offering...
She started her typical extensive preparations. I took a half-hearted bite of my sandwich, then put it down, overwhelmed suddenly with the urge to call my mom. Since my earlier efforts when she'd shut me down with the party line, we didn't talk about David Ibarra, ever. But sitting there, I suddenly felt so alone and craved someone, anyone who might understand.
Hey,
I heard a voice say. I looked up to see Mac, his trash in hand, standing over me.
You sure you're okay?
Sydney,
Layla said.
What's wrong?
I shook my head, quickly getting to my feet. The attention added to the scrutiny I'd imagined all day was suddenly too much.
I need to go, I said. I'll see you guys later.
No one said anything as I walked away. Nobody tried to follow me. I went to the bathroom and locked myself in a stall. Finally, I was alone, just like I'd wanted. It felt so awful, like it was just what I deserved. By that evening, things were back to normal at home. The paper was in the recycling, the news was moving on, and we would as well. But while my mom puttered around the kitchen making dinner in the usual conversation, I still felt strange, not only about the article, but the way I'd walked away from Layla and everyone else. She knew Peyton's history. I could have told her about the story, and yet I hadn't. I still wasn't sure why. It was just after dinner while I was helping to load the dishwasher that my phone beeped. Layla.
My mom wants you to come for dinner tomorrow. Yes? No? Maybe?
I looked over to the counter, where my own mother was making coffee for the next morning, as she did every night right after dinner. I waited for the beans, fair trade and organic, of course, to be done grinding before I said, Mom?
Yes?
She asked, walking over to the sink.
I'm going to have dinner at Layla's tomorrow, okay?
The first bad sign was when she put down the carafe only half filled with water. The second was the look on her face.
I need you here,
Sawyer and that advocate Michelle are coming over, remember? I hadn't, but now it all came back. After failing to find out what Peyton had done to lose visiting privileges, my mom had found a non-profit that helped families of prisoners navigate the legal system. During the last week, she'd had two meetings with a woman there named Michelle, reporting back that she was a lifesaver, so knowledgeable, and just the person we need in our corner. You guys will just be talking about Peyton, though, I said. Do I really need to be here? Her face tensed, that crease folding in between her eyebrows. It's important that we present a united, supportive front whenever possible. You are part of that. She turned back to the sink. I bit my lip, looking at my shoes as my dad came in and went to the freezer, pulling it open. He stood there for a minute before saying,
"Are we out of Rocky Road? Is that even possible?"
"Sydney doesn't want to come to dinner tomorrow," my mom replied, as if this had anything to do with his question. "Apparently she'd rather eat over at her new friend's house."
"What's happening tomorrow?"
my dad asked, pushing aside a carton of vanilla and looking behind it. My mom yanked up the top to the water chamber on the coffee maker hard enough that it banged against the cabinet behind it. "Sawyer, the advocate, dinner? Does anyone listen to anything I say?" My dad, who had found his rocky road, turned, the carton in his hands. He looked so surprised. I felt bad for him.
"Julie, what's wrong?"
"I'm just tired of being the only one who seems to care about Peyton." She shoved the carafe into its place. "I don't ask you both to visit with me. I don't ask you to keep track of all the dates and issues that must be kept up with. But I think I should be able to ask you to have dinner in your own house, if it's not too much trouble."
"Mom," I said, "I'll be here."
"Of course she will."
My dad put down the ice cream and walked over, putting his hands on her shoulders.
"Honey, it's okay. We'll do whatever you need."
"It's not for me," she said, her voice cracking. "That's the whole point." "No can do," I texted Layla later from my room. "Family stuff. Wish I could." Nothing for a few minutes. Finally, a beep. "You sure you're okay?" I hesitated, my finger over the keyboard. "No," I wrote back. "I'm not." Another pause, shorter this time. Then, "Sleep over Saturday, yes?" There was not a no or a maybe provided this time. Sometimes fewer choices can be a good thing. "We'll try," I replied. And then, after a moment, "Thank you." "XO," she wrote back. And then, as if I had already chosen after all, "See you then." Sawyer Ambrose was a big, beefy guy with curly white hair whose cheeks were always red. He was like Santa, but in a business suit instead of a red fur-trimmed one. When I opened the door the following evening, right at 6:30, he was standing there with a bottle of wine, a cheesecake, and a smile.
"Sydney," he said, "how are you?"
"Good," I replied. "Come on in." As I stepped aside to let him pass, Ames's red Lexus pulled into the driveway. He got out right away and waved at me, which meant, unless I wanted to shut the door in his face, I had no choice but to stand there as he came up the walk. He opened his arms, then said,
"Hey, long time no see."
I hated the hugging. It was relatively new, having been instituted after the weekend he'd stayed with me. There was really no way to turn down a hug without looking like a bitch. And these were particularly squeezy and long. I let myself be drawn in and tried not to tense up totally as he slid his hands around me.
"Rough week, huh?" he said. "You doing okay?"
"Yeah,"
I said, managing to untangle myself. Mom's inside.
Great.
He smiled at me, then headed down the hallway, where I heard him greet Sawyer.